Welcome back to the Mojo Podcast, a place for curious minds to fill up on leadership inspiration and hear wonderful stories of mojo, lost and found, high and low. I'm your host, Richard Stokes, and we meet here every fortnight to spend time with a diverse and brilliant group of guests who've been generous to spend time with me. This series of the Mojo Podcast is all about commitment, a concept we all understand, but that can prove elusive, even fearful for us. In this series, I wanted to get under the skin of commitment, how we can commit to ourselves, to our values, our purpose, and the payoff we can see when we literally choose not to have any more choice. Commitment is one of life's beautiful paradoxes. My wonderful guest this week is Holly Budge, a passionate conservationist, adventurer, and the driving force behind World Female Ranger Week, someone who Sir David Attenborough has personally thanked for her work saving African elephants. Holly's story is not just about adrenaline and records, although she has plenty of those, from skydiving alongside Mount Everest to leading challenging expeditions all over the world. Her real adventure lies in her mission-driven shift towards purposeful and impactful conservation work. Over the past decade, through her NGO, How Many Elephants, Holly has worked with all-female and mixed anti-poaching teams in Africa and worldwide, witnessing firsthand the transformational power these women hold, and also the risks they take every day to protect endangered animals from the poaching trade.
I've spent a huge amount of time with ranger teams on the front line. I've been part of ambushes. I've spent time with women that are fully armed with AK-47s, like the Akashinga Rangers in Zimbabwe. There's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide when you're dropped out deep in the bush. There's wildlife out there and there's signs of poachers out there. It can just turn into an indiscriminate shootout. So it's a very volatile situation.
In this episode, we delve into Holly's personal experiences and profound impact in the world of conservation. We understand more about the power of media in driving global awareness around conservation and the inspiring stories of female rangers fighting against the odds. Join us as we explore the depths of Holly's adventures and hear her mindset of think big and start small. Essentially, her encouragement that we could all conquer our own personal Everests when we truly commit. I hope you love this conversation as much as I did. Please do rate and review and share with your network. Okay. Over to my Mojo conversation with Holly Budge. Welcome back to the Mojo podcast. And I'm delighted to welcome my guest today, Holly Budge. Holly joins us from Surrey in the UK. Hey, Holly, how are you doing?
Hey, Richard. I'm doing great. Thank you.
Well, it's great to see you. And so we always start here before we get into anything else. Your Mojo today out of 10, what would you give yourself?
I'm going to go for a good mojo day. I'm going for an 8.
An 8. So an 8 out of 10. That represents a good mojo day. Okay.
So,
give me a bit of what's going on behind that then. Because when I say the word mojo, it tends to mean different things to different people. What came up for you when I said that?
Whenever I think of the word mojo, I just think of Austin Powers.
Yes.
Mojo for me is... good productivity and feeling good, feeling confident and feeling in the zone, I reckon.
Feeling in the zone, confident, productive. And what helps you get there? Because you calibrated yourself very quickly. This was a good mojo day. This was an 8. How do you get that sense for yourself of where you're at?
I think at the minute I'm just firing on everything because I'm leading into my campaign World Female Ranger Week, which we're going to talk about. So it's just all on, you know, the lead into that is, you know, whether I've got my mojo or not, it's all on. So I think also today, because I've been chatting a lot, I've been talking to people, doing interviews, and I think that really raises my mojo as well, just rather than being at home looking at a laptop, really connecting with people and having good, productive conversations.
Yeah, okay, I hear you. So I get the sense of you being on purpose, and we're going to come back to that word because I know that's important to you throughout the conversation. And you mentioned World Female Ranger Week, which is happening very soon. And we're going to talk to that. And there'll be lots of links to that in the show notes because we really want people to find out more about that. And we're going to talk a lot about what's behind that too. And I'd also like to ask you, so people listening who maybe haven't come across you in the past, what do people need to know about you to get the most out of this podcast, this time that we're spending together today?
Oh, there's a question. I think in a nutshell, I'm an adventurer, Everest summiteer, first woman to skydive Everest. I've raced 1,000 kilometers across Mongolia on semi-wild horses. But my true passion and my purpose is my conservation work through my UK registered charity, How Many Elephants, and World Female Ranger Week. And for me these days, Richard, my definition of adventure has very much shifted from world firsts and world records to adventure with purpose, which for me is patrolling and spending prolonged periods of time on the front line with all female and mixed anti-poaching teams in Africa.
Right. Won't we dive in with that? Because that, I know that's what's going on right now. We'll circle back to some other things as well. Because I think for me, you're... this spirit of adventure, this the course you've picked for yourself in life, which might not be the most, I guess, standard, and really picking, you know, following your passions and purpose, that, you know, what I mentioned up top. I really want to circle back to that because it probably explains quite a lot as well. But let's dive into what's going on right now for you with, obviously, with How Many Elephants and your charity and World Female Ranger Week. So maybe it's a provoking question, but why does the world need a female ranger week, Holly? Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I think that is a fantastic question. So for me, I wanted to create a platform to celebrate the incredible and inspiring women that I've spent time with on the front line in Africa. And I've been working with female rangers now for the past decade. Since the first all-female anti-poaching team was launched in South Africa, possibly the world's first all-female team. And I just, wanted to create this platform to share their stories and amplify their voices in the global media. And so I created World Female Ranger Day in 2021, spotlighting Africa in the first year. And that just, it just went bonkers. We got around 360 million views around this one day. All the major global news platforms were picking up the stories. And so the following year, I made it World Female Ranger Week, and I now work with women, female rangers globally. So about 5,500 female wildlife rangers that I'm championing and supporting and working with. And lots of people say, why female rangers? Long story short, women are just proving to be so successful in that role on the front line. Quick backstory to that. The founder of the Black Mambas, the first all-female team in Africa, they're based in South Africa. The founder was just hitting his head on a brick wall back in 2013, losing elephants and rhinos at such an alarming rate. He just didn't know what to do. And that's when he came upon this idea to go into the local communities and invite women to come forward and try out as rangers, go through a pretty rigorous training. 10 years on, we're seeing the ripple out effect of employing local women. And it's just phenomenal, Richard, like on a level from, them being the breadwinners, buying land, building houses, getting an education. Some of them have got degrees, kids are in school, and they've got access to healthcare or much better healthcare than they did. Mm. They're just some of the things we're seeing 10 years on from the Black Mambas starting.
Wow. And so to paint a bit of a context, I guess, around it. So pre the Black Mambas creating this all-female group, had it been either difficult or impossible for women to be rangers in the countries of, you talk about Africa, for example? Was there a big blocker to that, to women joining?
Huge. Yeah. I mean, what I'm, even though I'm working with women on opposite sides of the planet, a very common thread is social stigma. So that was would have been a real barrier for women getting into this profession. But now the World Female Ranger movement is just picking up momentum at a really fast pace, because the women are not only proving successful on the front line, but they're also using the power of conversation to go into local communities, ease local tensions, and really strengthen relationships.
In there, is that some of the reason why, for example, the Black Mambas have seen this, this turnaround in numbers? And, oh, and can you give me a sense of, again, for context, just how many elephants or rhinos were or are being lost, just to give this, a sense of obviously the importance
Yeah,
of.
absolutely. So that's where it all started for me when I was studying for my master's at the University of Brighton. And I was actually studying a material called vegetable ivory, which is a nut from a palm tree from South America. And it's almost identical in color and texture to elephant ivory. And that's what got me researching the African elephant crisis. And I was reading statistics, like 96 elephants being poached each day for their ivory. So I wanted to use my skills as a graphic designer to come up with a fresh awareness-raising campaign to visualize this data. So I built this necklace, 96 elephants out of vegetable ivory. And it's won 5 design awards so far. It's quite a piece. And the whole thing with my work is it's non-gruesome, it's non-gory, it's non-political, it transcends language barriers, it transcends cultural barriers. And then to accompany the necklace is my exhibition that travels around the world, and that shows the annual poaching rate of elephants in Africa, and that's 35,000 elephants a year. So to
Wow.
put that into context, there's under 400,000 elephants left in the wild in Africa.
Wow. So really under threats, a massive crisis, and all male or traditional male-led anti-poaching rangers weren't quite getting there. And then here come the Black Mamba group, all female, and they're making this change. And you talked about, the power of conversation. What else is it? What is it about, the feminine energy, perhaps, that was making this change? Because it's, and you and tell me that you'll tell me about this as well, but this is not, this is dangerous. This is really dangerous work, right?
This is really dangerous work. So I just want to jump in there and say my whole work with female rangers, it's absolutely nothing against the male rangers, and it's not saying that they're not doing their job correctly, because they're doing a fantastic job. But it's just about recognizing that women have different unique needs compared to the male rangers. And my idea of a sort of an ideal situation is a mixed ranger team. So I've spent a huge amount of time with lots of different teams. Some of these female rangers are armed teams with AK-47s. Some of them are unarmed. Some of them are in mixed teams. And I think that, for me anyway, I think that's a fantastic solution to having the mixed team in there. So to answer your question, what qualities do the women have? I've seen these women in action firsthand, and these ladies, they're tough and they're strong, and I've spent a lot of time interviewing them and chatting with them, really trying to delve deep into what drives and motivates them to do this often very ch challenging and dangerous work. And these ladies said to me, many of them have come from just huge adversity. Some of them are AIDS orphans, some of them are in abusive marriages and wanted a way to escape that, just huge poverty, marginalization. And they said when they heard about the opportunity to go for ranger selection and training, they said, "We just didn't have anything to lose. We just grabbed it with both hands and went for it." But I think women naturally are very nurturing creatures. And I think those qualities definitely shine through with the women, but also, as I said, using the power of conversation, going in and really working with the local communities and just talking it through. It seems to be having a huge impact. Plus, they are fantastic role models for young women, other women around the world. So, they're not only on the front line of conservation, they're role models, they're educators, and they're beacons of hope in their communities and beyond.
Wow, so it sounds like with being empowered with this role, this really crucial job, that obviously there's the immediate impact what I'm hearing from you in terms of the anti-poaching piece, but then there's all this other education and conversation that's going on, you might say behind the scenes, but it's equally as important, obviously, as well.
And I've been back to some of the communities with some of these amazing women, and they're in their full camos and they're just overflowing with pride, driving their 4x4 vehicle. And they said, this one lady, she said to me, all the men in the community when I was growing up said that women could never drive or never drive big vehicles, let alone become a ranger. So, seeing that side of it as well, seeing the respect that they're getting from their families, the community. But I don't think it was always like that. They've really had to prove that and work that. And for a woman being out in the bush, sleeping next to a man that she's not married to or not related to, all of those sorts of cultural norms as well are being challenged too.
Yeah, right, and you sort of mentioned in terms of it sounds like the women becoming the breadwinner perhaps in the family, and that must be countercultural and probably quite challenging in some of these. I'm thinking about the African context particularly.
Yeah, and I mean, there's research out there that's sort of UN research that say women put 80% of their income back into their families. So that's a huge stat there that we can look at when you're looking at the ripple effect of all the benefits of employing women, especially over the long term. But there's also research out there and through first-hand accounts to say that violence in the home can increase because the woman is the breadwinner, and that definitely causes some issues in the home, in like personal relationships.
So in terms of coming back to, I guess the why behind why you set up World Female Ranger Week, there's funding, there's support here that's needed on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, there's a great expression that I use a lot, and that is conservation without funding is just conversation. So World Female Ranger Week is a platform to share their stories, to raise awareness, but also attract donors in as well. So that's a hugely important part of it.
And on so on the so we talked a little bit about the Rangers and what they're doing, and I'm sure we'll talk a bit more, but I'm also intrigued about the poachers, about the people that are out there, killing elephants and rhinos for the ivory, obviously to sell to make money. Tell me a bit about them, because I don't really have a good understanding of, beyond obviously the money motivation, but what's going on for them, what's driving them to this.
So I mean, there's if you can imagine a scale, on one end of the scale, you've got people that are desperate, people that have probably hired, a gun to go into the national park or the reserves, to just opportunists to try and put food on the table. And you've got to ask yourself, if you're in that really desperate situation, you'd probably consider taking steps as well to try and look after your family. You do what it takes. And I always, think it's you compare that to people, for example, that are out there hunting just for fun, just for a sport. These guys, they're not out there for fun. Being a poacher is not an easy way to make a living. They're out there often, days or weeks at a time. It's the weather is, very challenging. And it's difficult and it's dangerous living out in the bush. So you kind of got that one end of the scale right to the other end of the scale, where it's highly organized, highly equipped, criminal syndicates. The illegal wildlife trade has been linked through to terrorist groups as well. So, in some instances, and a rhino horn from when it's poached could be in China, for example, within 24 hours. So that just gives you a sense of how much corruption there is all the way along the line to get a horn out of the country and into another country with customs and ports and all sorts. There's a whole lot of people involved in that operation to make that happen.
Right, so
So,
everyone's taking a little bit of something at
yep.
every point to facilitate the journey.
Yeah, and of course these each end of the scale meet at times when the opportunity the people that are just desperate at the end of one end of the scale, they're easy prey. You know, they're getting paid very small money for doing potentially a really dangerous job. But the difficulty is, if you said, you know, here's $100 for this is just made up numbers, but here's $100 for poaching an elephant, to go and kill an elephant, and here's $200 to do something legal and easier, they'll take both. They'll do the legal work and they'll do the illegal work, you know, because they're desperate and they want the money. And again, you know, you've got to ask yourself, if you were in that position, it's very easy for us to sit here and say this is right and this is wrong, but I don't make those judgments, you know. And especially when I do lots of work with schools with my campaign, I see it very often where the minute I arrive and I'm doing my workshop with the kids, and they say, oh, the poachers are the bad guys, you know, we want to kill the poachers. And then we start talking about that. We're like, well, you know, let's have a look at that. Are they the bad guys? Yeah, of course they are. They're not doing good. They're not the good guys. But then you've got to look at the bigger picture. And then you've got to think, are the bad guys the guys further up the chain that are, you know, taking advantage of people with much less fortunate situations than them? And you can see the children's brains sort of cogs starting to move. But, you know, it's not as black and white as saying, here's the hero and here's the baddie, you know? And obviously, sometimes the hero and the baddie could be the same person. And that's happened before, where, you know, rangers have been caught with the poachers, informing them where the wildlife is, etc. So again, very, very difficult situation, very complex.
And did you, when we talked briefly before, that it's been found that female rangers are significantly less corruptible than their male colleagues. Is that
Yeah, I
true?
mean, that's definitely the thoughts of lots of people I've spoken to. But let's take the Black Mambas in South Africa, for example. You know, as I said, they launched 2013, so coming on for their 11th year, and not one Black Mamba has ever failed a lie detector. So that just speaks volumes. You know, you can't really argue with that. So yeah, I think women definitely seemingly are looking like they're less corruptible.
And talk a bit about, because I know you've been out on patrol, right, with various ranger groups numerous times. What sort of experiences have you had then? And you talk a bit about the life of some of these poachers and what drives them and how desperate they are. You've talked about some of the female groups. You know, they've got AK-47s, and we set up this is dangerous work. What have you seen or experienced out there?
It's pretty scary at times. You know, it does make my adventures of skydiving Everest, climbing Everest, etc., look quite tame. So, you know, I've spent a huge amount of time with ranger teams on the front line. I've been part of ambushes. Quite often I'm the only one that's unarmed, more than often the only white person out there. I've spent time with women that are fully armed with AK-47s, like the Akashinga Rangers in Zimbabwe. You know, and that's quite scary, because you start thinking, you know, they're my lifeline, these women, and I barely know them, or I did when I first went out. And you've really just, there's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide when you're dropped out deep in the bush. There's wildlife out there, and there's signs of poachers out there. So, and then I sort of flip that on its head and think, actually, it's a huge responsibility as well that these women must feel, having me out there, you know, because they're such a tight unit. There's just such tight bonds, and then suddenly there's me as well. So you know, there's lots of different dynamics going on there. And you know, when you're out with a fully armed team like Akashinga, there's no armed response behind. So if we're sitting down in the darkness for 3, 4 hours, you know, in the dead of the night, waiting for torchlight, you know you're going in. There is no ringing somebody saying, you know, we found poachers. It's us that's moving in. I've also been part of a few ambushes. One of them was in Zimbabwe as well, different area than the Akashinga. And you know, that was terrifying. I actually filmed the whole thing on my iPhone, and I was just lying flat on the ground with the rangers. They're all armed. This was with male rangers, and I could hear voices coming around that corner. And you just don't know what's coming around there. You don't know if they're caught in the act, if they've got elephant tusks or rhino horns on them. You know, the last thing poachers want to do is be caught. So if you kind of
Right.
stumble across them and they stumble across you, it can just turn into an indiscriminate shootout. So it's a very volatile situation. In that instance, it turned out to be children, and their dads just abandoned them. The dads
God.
ran off, and the kids, you know, the kids got sort of arrested, and then they had hunting dogs with them, and one of the dogs got shot as a warning to the dads and the community that had moved into the national park illegally, that the rangers meant business, and that the dads never came forward. You know, they never appeared that day.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it was pretty intense situation. And these kids, you know, the kids, the rangers were chatting to them. They didn't go to school. They weren't allowed to go to school. You know, they're out there with catapults, and you know, it doesn't take a lot when you grow up in a community where poaching is completely normal to maybe think of poaching as being something aspirational.
Right.
You see a poacher in your community driving around with a big car, you know, and a new phone, and you know, all this material wealth to them, then you could see how that could impression younger minds for sure.
Yeah, because if, you know, we know that our experience helps form our beliefs, and if that's your experience, you know, my father, my uncles, my friends are doing this, seems to be okay. Therefore, your belief would be, well, okay, then I'll do the same. It'd be very hard actually to break that cycle, wouldn't it? I mean, is some of the education that you talked about going to villages and stuff, is some of it around that, to the
A
educational piece? Yeah.
huge amount is around that. I was in a classroom once, and we asked the kids what they wanted to be when they were older, and one kid put their hand up and said, "I want to be a poacher." Again, it's not their fault. You know, you wouldn't even question it. A bit like, you know, with my exhibition, the 35,000 elephants, I had two Chinese ladies come to the opening event, and they burst into tears and said, "We just simply didn't know. We hadn't thought about it. We just figured, we didn't even think about it, but we figured elephant tusks fall out, regrow, like rhino horn." And they said, "It's just so deeply ingrained in our culture and beliefs that didn't even question it." So I think
Right.
that's why education is so important.
Yeah. So as them as the essentially the end consumer of this tusk, they'd be buying this tusk for, you know, whatever purpose, and they just had no idea.
For trinkets,
Yeah.
medicinal purposes, you know, whatever you want to turn your ivory into.
Yeah.
But yeah, it gives you a sense of, you know, that if you have no reason to question these things, you never would.
Yeah. And so what, let's come back to purpose then. And what you I can tell you're clearly on purpose. You're highly driven and passionate about this. What's led you, maybe this is a bit of the backstory now, what's led you to here, Ollie? Because as I said right at the top, this isn't the average path that most of us walk in life. You've chosen a particular route, and you know, with absolute like clarity and purpose behind it. So what's brought you to that, do you think?
So I'll tell you the backstory, but I have another expression that I love, and that specific is terrific. And the more specific I can be, the more impact I can make. So
Yeah.
that's why I'm very specific about African elephants and female rangers.
Yeah.
So I'm just putting that forward
No,
there.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, so when I was 21, I did a skydive in New Zealand, tandem skydive, and I just was blown away that people were getting paid to jump out of planes every day of the year, and nobody had told me about this as a career move. And I just had a moment where I thought, this is what I want to do. I want to move to New Zealand and I want to get employed as a skydiving camera woman. Massive goal. Pretty audacious thinking, looking back, because I knew nothing about skydiving, I knew nothing about filming, and I didn't know anyone in New Zealand, but none of that mattered because I knew I could learn those skills or I could have a go. And I've tried to keep that positive mindset going where you don't overthink things, don't procrastinate too much. And eventually I did land my job as a skydiving camera woman. And it was a magical time in my life. I was in my early 20s and I was getting paid to jump out of planes 12 times a day, every day. And what that did was it gave me this massive confidence and this self-belief that I could do whatever I put my mind to or I could have a go. So fast forward a few years, I then heard about the opportunity to take part in a world first expedition where we'd be skydiving next to Mount Everest. And when I rang the organizer, it quickly became apparent there were no other women signed up on this expedition. So I knew that was my hook for getting sponsors on board. And I wanted to become the first woman to skydive Everest. And he said, "Can I count you on board, Holly?" And I said, "Yep." And he said, "That would be £24,000." And I was like, "Okay."
Yes, do
And
you take Visa or MasterCard?
that just set the bar to go out
Yeah.
and find sponsors and get people to
Wow.
buy into me. And that's exactly what I did. It's never an easy task getting sponsors. I think my easiest sponsor to date was when I was climbing Everest, and that was a lobster farmer from North Wales who just wanted to talk about my adventures with his mates down the pub on a Friday night. And I was like, okay,
Wow.
I can
I can
definitely
do
help you
that.
do that. So I did the skydive. I jumped from 29,500 feet from a small plane, a Pilatus Porter, that had never flown to that altitude before. So we didn't even know if we were going to make it to that height. And then the first person to skydive Everest jumped out. Then my camera flyer climbed outside onto the step. I moved to the door, ready, set, go. Camera flyer's hand pushing me back into the plane. Pilot had held up the stop sign. Don't let the jumpers out. It was too late. I had too much momentum on my go, and I fell out of the plane. So you
Oh
put all
my.
this time into visualizing how this is going to be, and as a reasonably experienced skydiver, you definitely didn't envisage falling out of the plane. And it was almost complete cloud cover, so I had no visuals on the ground below. So that was a bit of a worry, because when you're out in the Himalayas, there's very few places to make safe landings. So it was really important that I made it back there, and I did make it back. And then about 2 minutes after I landed, complete whiteout, couldn't see anything. So the weather's just so changeable at those
Wow.
altitudes. Next thing I know, a microphone in front of my face. I'm giving an interview. That's Reuters, the global news agency. I get back to Kathmandu the next day to fly home. I'm on the front of the Kathmandu Times. I got upgraded thanks to Virgin on the way home. And then I got put in a hotel room courtesy of the BBC in London for 24 hours and did six live TV interviews, two of which went out live to America, CNN and CBS. And I was on the breakfast show, the red sofa. And naively, I wasn't really prepared for the level of media this got, and I was kind of thrown into this world of TV and radio and press. And it was quite exciting, really, but also it made me think to myself, how can I harness the power of the global media for a greater good than me jumping out of an aeroplane? So fast forward now to 3 years ago, 2021, and subsequent years to now. You know, World Female Ranger Week is getting, last year we had 500 million views around that week.
Yeah.
So for me, that's impact, that's purpose way bigger than me, which is fantastic. So that's kind of, I guess, the seed was sown on that first adventure, the skydive Everest. But also then I realized that my adventures were a brilliant platform for me to get sponsors, get funding, get more media attention. So I carried on doing these big adventures. 2017, I climbed Everest as a two-person team on the north side and took the How Many Elephants flag to the summit. And you know, again, just adventure is a great tool. And as much as I
Yeah.
love adventuring, I'd never say adventuring is my passion or my purpose. You know, back in the day, I loved world records, world firsts. Now that just, I couldn't be further from that. That just
Yeah.
doesn't interest me at all,
Yeah.
chasing records. You know, now it's using adventure as a powerful platform to for environmental and conservation purposes.
Yeah. So more, it's I see the arc you've gone on.
Yeah.
Is now it's this is a means to an end rather than it just for the pure experience. And I get a lot of people do have adventure. It drives them. I've had people on this podcast before who are absolutely of that mindset. And I understand also for you it's shifted. And you know, as it does, as we experience different things and there are different needs that
Yeah,
come up.
and to date I've raised over £500,000. So, you know,
Wow.
it's a huge platform, the adventure platform, and to trying to raise money is hard enough anyway,
Yeah.
running a non-profit. But you know, I guess it's more enjoyable and it's more you know, it's easier to promote something when there's a good looking adventure behind it. So
Yeah, again, you know, we're humans. We love stories, and we are driven and we're drawn towards stories like the campfire, and that's what we want to understand. I also get this sense it's a huge amount of commitment from you, and commitment is kind of the sub theme really of this series of the Mojo podcast. So I just wanted to like drill you a little bit for like where commitment comes from for you, because you're showing a huge amount of that. And also, are there times when you feel, you know what, I'm just not sure, or the self-belief dips, the confidence dips, and therefore the commitment might.
Definitely.
Does that happen?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not superhuman in any way. Like I definitely question myself, and I sometimes think, can I be doing more? Which is, you know, I give a lot anyway. I don't make any money from my charity, and that probably takes 80% of my time. I make money from my speaking, so I go in and speak to corporates and at events and conferences and all sorts. And ironically, it's Everest and skydiving Everest that gets me booked, that gets me in the front door. But once I'm in, I'm able to talk about my adventures, but also talk about conservation and elephants and female rangers. And that seems to work as a nice mix. But if I was trying to get booked straight off conservation and elephants, I think it would be much more challenging in some cases. I think we all have moments of imposter syndrome and questioning yourself and, you know, should I be doing this? Am I good enough to be doing this? And I work a huge amount on my own, you know, on my laptop, as many of us do. And sometimes that's really lonely. So I guess going back to my first question of Mojo's high is when you're chat, you know, having amazing, you know, conversations with, you know, all sorts of people. You know, like this week, I've just had some brilliant conversations with women all over the world who are on the ground, embedded in conservation projects, just doing amazing things. And then they say to me at the end of the call, "Oh, I feel so small compared to what you're doing," as in compared to what I'm doing. So it's just this whole skewed perspective on things. You know, I think we all put other people, you know, we put people on a pedestal, but we never put ourselves on that pedestal. And I don't mean in an arrogant way. Just, you know, I think it's just a human nature thing to think that, you know, everyone else out there is smashing it and you're not, you know?
Yes,
And
I think that's it.
I don't think social media helps with that at all.
Well, just what I was going to talk about was comparison. Comparison being the theft of joy, often. I mean, there can be some healthy elements to comparison, but generally, we tend to look and go, as you were saying, oh, that person's doing so much better than me. In whatever the field, it might be more better, more successful. And that can really rob you of that joy. And I think, we've all got our own personal Everests, right, in life. And you've scaled actual Everest, but I get a sense from the way you share your story and your message and your humanity and humility with it that I'm sure helps propel people on. What are some of the things when you're doing? I appreciate the speaking. Come in and talk about adventure, and then you get to share about conservation. What are some of the things that will often come up or you like to share in your speaking gigs?
Yeah, so I'll definitely have some key messages in there around setting big goals and mindset. So one of my favorite expressions is think tall, start small. So, like get prepared. Don't be one of those people like I met on Everest who had never stepped foot on snow before or never put a pair of crampons on before, and they're going for the summit. And then you chat to the Sherpas and they said, sometimes we're having to hide behind people on the summit because they're not conscious to hold their own body weight up.
Oh,
And you
wow.
just think, well, where's the adventure in that? Oh yeah, I was there, but I wasn't conscious. I don't have any memory of it. So I think get prepared, show up prepared, learn the skills. And that's a theme that goes throughout my talk is I didn't know those skills. So I learned them, or I at least had a go. So any big, audacious goal I've ever set has started with a simple decision to try to have a go. That's kind of my thing. Another thing that I teach through my speaking is win or learn. So, most achievements don't happen in a linear fashion. So it's about embracing the setbacks, embracing those detours, and often that's where the gold is. That's where the really powerful life lessons are. So I think, if you have a setback, it's just reframing that, learning from that and moving on. Another one of mine is, which I love, is smile through the pain. And it works. When you're at your lowest ebb and you don't think you've got anything left, you can smile. Smile. And a positive mindset is a resilient mindset. So I've got lots of these little techniques that I use, but they really do work. And they're such simple things. So, I definitely I like to sort of people to go away with relatable, actionable takeaways that they can then incorporate into there. Because otherwise you can feel like you're a bit removed. A lot of people will say, I can relate to you being on the front line and it being scary. I can relate to, coming face to face with an elephant is really scary, but I can't relate to wanting to climb Everest, or I can't relate to jumping out of an aeroplane over Everest. That's just too far removed for a lot of people. So my role as a speaker is taking lessons that I've learned and making them relatable.
Yeah, I love that. I appreciate it, tried and tested at 30,000 feet, but this is applicable in your home, in your boardroom, in your sports team, and something more that you want to do is say you need that encouragement to think bigger and go for your dreams. They're all around us, aren't they? It doesn't have to be a world's first. It doesn't have to be the world's tallest mountain to test yourself on.
I regularly get messages from people that have been to my talks and they said, "Oh, I've climbed my Everest because I was inspired by your story." And for them, that might be, going to the gym and joining an exercise class. Or one woman never drove at night. She was so scared. And now she's like, "Now I drive at," just things that seem quite small to the majority of people, but to them, that's huge. I love that. I love when I hear stories like that.
Amazing, amazing. And that's what we know. I think, as I said, we're drawn to stories, we're drawn to inspirational stories, which is kind of why this podcast exists Anyway, so I'm so pleased to have you on today, Holly. Before we close, I'd love to know. Obviously, we've got World Female Ranger Week, 23rd to the 30th of June this year. Massive focus. And what is next for you? What is out there in terms of your next big, hairy, audacious goal that you can share?
Yeah, so my big audacious goal, I've just set up a tour operator, which is very new ground for me. I've worked closely with the travel industry for the last 6 years, but as a non-profit, and I'm really excited by this. So I will be taking small groups of people, six people, with me out to the front line to patrol with these rangers, meet these ladies, and have a fantastic holiday around it as well, but really get immersed into the inner workings of an anti-poaching team and see where the money that that we're raising through that, where that's being spent. So I've got three
Wow.
trips coming up. The confirmed ones are South Africa and Kenya, and I'm just so excited. I think this is a whole new form of experiential philanthropy, really seeing and experiencing and feeling conservation firsthand. So that's consuming a lot of my time right now. So
Yeah, bet.
my company's called Wildlife Positive Travel, and that will be launching alongside World Female Ranger Week, June 23rd to the 30th, as you said. And then adventure-wise, just for fun, I've doing quite a lot of bike packing. So I'm meant to be doing the Silk Road mountain race again, which is this August in Kyrgyzstan, 1900 kilometers solo, self-supported in under 14 days.
Wow.
So it's brutal. I mean, it really hurts, but that is a holiday for me. That's me taking time out.
Smile through the
Mile
pain.
through.
That
Do you
is
know one
funny.
lady who's an ultra runner who's a great friend of mine? She's actually tattooed "Smile Through the Pain" on her wrist, and she said it
That
just,
constant reminder.
oh, constant when she's doing her crazy running races. It's right there.
Amazing. Well, look, Holly, I'm so appreciative of you sharing your time before. I know what is a really busy week coming up for you, but great that we can get on and talk about it. As you say,
Yeah, pleasure.
conservation without interest and funding, importantly, coming through is just the conversation. We want to do more than that. So we'll put all the links for people to make donations, etc., in the show notes. And obviously found out about your new adventure travel. Venture, which I know
Yep.
my young boys are quite young, but when they're a bit older, I would love to do that. That having that kind of experience would just be incredible. So I might mark a
Yeah.
booking for a few years hence and join you.
Absolutely.
Join
Absolutely.
you.
Thank
Wonderful, Holly. Great to have you. Thank you so much for joining the Mojo podcast today.
you, Richard. It's been a pleasure.
I love this chat. So much passion and conviction in what she's doing, and of course, so much commitment. And with that, I get the sense of an amount of sacrifice too that Holly has given to create the campaigns that she has. I think when I first got in touch with her, I thought we'd spend most of our time talking about all this derring do of climbing Everest and skydiving Everest, when actually it's clear her true passion lies in her conservation work and the adventuring is clearly a means to an end to focus attention on the plight of endangered species at the hands of poachers. So much courage and bravery and frankly single-mindedness. As she says, specific is terrific, and I love all of her one-liners. She's a super inspiring public speaker, so if you'd like to get Holly into your business or your school or organisation, you can get in touch with her via links in the show notes. So thanks again for listening, and please do share this episode as widely as possible. Until next time, I hope your mojo continues to flow.